Everybody, welcome to MEC. We're delighted that you're here. I want to welcome also everyone watching at our sites in Lake Norman and Mountain Island Lake and Fujairah and a lot of other places over the internet. I want to do an experiment. It's an experiment where I'm going to use my masterful musical abilities, and I'm going to do a song on this drum. And what you have to do is when I do this song, you need to decide if you can guess what the song is. Don't shout it out unless you're just naturally obnoxious. Keep it to yourself and play well with others in the sandbox and just guess in your head. I'm going to tap it out and actually tap out the song as clearly as I know how, and then I'm just going to ask honestly if you think you know what that song is. Okay, here we go. How many of you think you know what that song was? Okay. It was Adele's Rolling in... No, actually, it was... That was Happy Birthday. Let's see if you can get it this time. Hear it now? Okay, because you know the song. If some of you still don't get it, you're just hopeless. Now... This was an actual experiment done at Stanford University. They found that listeners were only able to guess right about 2.5% of the time. They got three songs out of every 120. Now, here's what's interesting. The tapper, who was thinking of the song and knew the song while he or she was doing it, they thought they were getting like almost all of them. Like, you know, at least one out of every two. So the listeners were only getting like one out of every 40. The tapper thought they were getting one out of every two. The difference was the tapper heard the song in his head. And when they were tapping it, they couldn't imagine the other person not hearing the song in the background, like they were just giving it away. Okay, this is called the curse of knowledge. That's its technical name, the curse of knowledge. Once we know something, then we find it hard to imagine what it's like to not know it. Well, we're in this series called Sent, and it's a look at how Jesus lived a sent life, sent on a search and rescue mission to planet Earth. But that's not all. He then turned around to those of us who follow him and said, "Now that I have lived this life and modeled this life, I'm now sending you." Now, here's what's interesting. The reason why leading a sent life is so strategic, particularly to those of us in the United States, is because of the curse of knowledge. There's so much Christian cultural baggage that we tend to think everybody knows about Jesus. Everybody knows. Christianity is known to everybody, so making it known isn't that big of a deal. We think everybody knows the song. Everybody knows, which is why the United States sends its Christian missionaries abroad. You know, if anybody needs to know, it's somewhere out there. The problem is out there. It's not here. In fact, according to the Center for the Study of Global Christianity, in 2010, the United States sent out 127,000 of the world's estimated 400,000 missionaries. Now, to put that into perspective, the United States was number one and sent out 127,000. The second place was Brazil. They only sent out 34,000. I mean, this is what we do. This is how we do it. But here's the irony. We live in a day where we need those missionaries sent here. One of the most important sociological studies that came out in recent months on American spiritual life was the American Religious Identification Survey, or the ARIS study. Much in the study was really expected. I mean, it said things like, well, you know, mainline denominations are losing ground, the Bible Belt is less Baptist, Catholics have invaded the South, denominationalism as a whole is fading. But here's what made the headlines, and it was alarming. It was the increase in the category of the nuns, not N-U-N-S, N-O-N-E-S. meaning people who said when it came to faith, when it came to religion, when it came to spirituality, they checked the box, none, nothing. That category doubled, making those who claimed no religion at all as the third largest defined constituency of the United States. The only groups bigger were Catholics and Baptists. In fact, the nuns were the only religious bloc to rise in percentage in every single state, thus making it the only true national trend. We have one national religious trend, and that is people becoming nothing. Simply put, Christian America is not Christian America. It's become a mission field. So what does that mean? Well, let me read this scripture from Romans. Anyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. But how can they call on him to save them unless they believe in him? And how can they believe in him if they have never heard about him? And how can they hear about him unless someone tells them? And how will anyone go and tell them without being sent? That is what the scriptures mean when they say, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. You know what God says to each one of us? I want you in this game. I want you to flesh this out in such a way that you are actually one of the ones making this happen. This isn't about sitting back and watching. This is about you actively playing a part. I want you to be sent. I want you to go. The DNA structure of what I'm calling you to be a part of is radically aggressive because there's no other way people will hear and there's no other way they'll ever know the song. It's in your head. Don't you think for a second that it's in theirs. Because it's not. But now here's where it all breaks down. We have like zero urgency about this. Like zero. I read an article a while back in the Atlantic Monthly where the author was describing his spiritual condition. And he was relaying in there how somebody asked him about his religion. And he was about to say he was an atheist when suddenly it dawned on him that that wasn't really quite accurate. He said, I used to call myself an atheist, and I still don't believe in God, but the larger truth that is that it has been years since I've cared. And so, in truth, I'm not an atheist as much as I am an apatheist. And then he went on to describe, you know, apathy. You know, I don't care that much about my own religion, and I really don't care about other people's religion. But it's what he wrote next that has haunted me ever since I read it. Let me just quote him. He said, but I have Christian friends who organize their lives around an intense and personal relationship with God, but who portray no sign of caring that I am an unrepentantly atheistic Jewish homosexual. They seem to also be apatheists, the kind that don't care what other people think about God or where they stand with him. This is the great danger of our day. Not caring. But we should. And for a reminder of this, I want to look at a story Jesus told that I still feel is one of the most startling. Every time I read it, it startles me in a different way. And I really do. I think it's one of the most stunning ones that ever came out of his mouth. It was about a man named Lazarus. It's in Luke chapter 14. Let me just read it. It's in its entirety. It's not long. And then let's unpack it. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen, and he lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, who was covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." He answered, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them, so that they will not also come to this place of torment." Now, that's like a cross between a Stephen King novel and The Twilight Zone. But it's such an important story. And Jesus told it for a very important reason. Just look at some of the takeaways that Jesus obviously had in mind. First, Jesus wanted to drive home the fact that everybody dies. The rich man was full of life, living it with joy and abundance. Jesus tells us that he was clothed in purple, fine linen, which in that day represented the ultimate in luxury. Death was the farthest thing from his mind, and nobody would have even thought about bringing the end of this guy's life to his attention. There was no sign of health issues, just nothing. And then he died. And it was sudden, it was unlooked for, and it was unexpected. Now, that's the way everybody dies. Sudden, unlooked for, and unexpected. Every one of you will die that way. In fact, I did some stats on this. About 300,000 people, between 250,000 and 300,000 people die suddenly, unlooked for, and unexpectedly every day. Do you know what the odds are being part of that number? 100%. Isn't it fascinating that the one sure thing in our life is the one thing we just refuse to talk about, own, or wrestle with? You'll die. 100% of you. Me too. We're all going to die. I'm just trying to cheer you up. We're all going to die. Your friends, 100% of them are going to die. Your family, 100% of them are going to die. Death is the only sure thing about life. Then second, Jesus moved on and wanted to make it absolutely clear that when we die, we face heaven or hell. Now, this is where it really gets uncomfortable, right? I mean, let's be honest. Heaven's fine. Hell is hard for us. We don't want to think about it. We don't want to believe in it. In fact, there was a study by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life that showed that while, you know, 74% of all Americans believe in heaven, barely half believe in hell. So the way we've got it set up in our own minds is heaven, yes, hell, no, in terms of our thinking. How that works out in a spiritual economy, I have no idea, but that's how it works out in here for us. Now, I did a whole talk on hell just a few months ago, and people agreed. It was a heck of a talk. So if you're interested in this, I would get hold of it so that you can see what the Bible has to say about hell. But let me say this. This is just commonsensical. If you don't think people are in spiritual trouble, then you probably don't believe in hell. If you don't believe in hell, then you don't believe people go there. If you don't believe people go there, then you're not going to have any sense of urgency about telling them how to avoid it. And if you don't have a sense of urgency about telling people how to avoid it, then you probably aren't going to care. You're not going to care about others. You're not really caring even about yourself. Jesus believed in hell. And this story fleshes it out. While the great and final judgment was yet to come for both of these men, it's very clear from the story that Jesus told that immediately upon our death, the fate of our lives is not only sealed, but the verdict of that inevitable judgment is set in motion. The beggar, Lazarus, was by Abraham's side, which, along with the concept of paradise, is mentioned in the Talmud as the home of the righteous, the place where the righteous dead go to await their future redemption and vindication. The rich man was in hell, or as it's more accurately written in the original Greek, he was in Hades. Hades is the place where the wicked go to await their final judgment. But as we see here, the pain and separation that comes from dying apart from God is already set in irreversible motion the moment you die. And the chasm between the two cannot be crossed. There's no do-overs, there's no second chances. Eternity is sealed. So Jesus tells first a story about the reality of death, and then second, about the reality of hell. But then did you notice what else was interesting about his story? The main character, the rich man, he was the last person you would probably have put into this story. I mean, this is the one guy you would not worry about spiritually. The rich guy was like a lot of folks in our day. There's no indication that he was a bad man. He's not said to have committed any grave sin. We're not aware of any personal or emotional issues. He probably was well thought of in the community. Nobody around him would have said, man, if you're going to tell a story about someone in spiritual trouble and, you know, going to hell and all that, I mean, okay, pick that guy and pick that guy, but you wouldn't pick him. I mean, he's fine. I mean, he's not in trouble. There's no urgency spiritually around his life. He just didn't know God. I mean, he knew about him, but he just didn't know him. No real relationship. That's not a big deal, is it? I think it's very important to note the kind of person Jesus used in this story. The person in need, the person in trouble, the person he chose to illustrate the urgency of reaching out is the last person on earth most of us would think of reaching out to because they don't look like they're in any kind of real trouble. But they are. And then Jesus relays a remarkable, one last little thing I thought was just remarkable. He ends the story with the guy having this remarkable change in spirit and attitude and priorities and heart. I mean, did you catch it? Once he realized he was dead, once he realized he was in hell, once he realized he had been in trouble in his life and didn't know it, what happened? He got really interested in missionary work. I mean, really, 5 minutes in hell made this guy a flaming evangelist. The person who lived for the world and cared little for God, and obviously in relation to a poor man like Lazarus, didn't really have a big heart toward other people, suddenly became a card-carrying director of personal outreach. Why? Because suddenly, he knew it was all real. And once he knew it was all real, nothing mattered more than warning those he cared about. He didn't even care about himself anymore. All he knew was that hell was not a figment of somebody's imagination, that it was for real, and real people go there for eternity. And he knew intuitively that the only way to break through the life of somebody like him, the kind of life that he had lived, is if somebody would go to them and talk to them. Somebody that knows them, a friend, a family member, somebody who would just make it clear to them. And he was willing for the first time in his life to be that person, which is absolutely critical to note. Not only did the need kick in, but so did the sense he had of personal responsibility. And that's something that needs to kick in for a lot of us as well. See, here's the deal. Not only do we think there isn't a real need, not only do we not believe in hell, not only do we not believe people are in spiritual trouble, but even if we did, we don't think it's our responsibility. You know, one of the most tragic events in recent American history occurred in New York City in 1964. There was a young woman from Queens named Kitty Genovese, and she was stabbed to death. She was chased by her assailant and attacked three separate times on a street over the course of half an hour, which in and of itself is tragic enough. But it happened while 38 of her neighbors watched. They watched from windows, they watched from around corners, they watched from doorsteps. And during that entire half-hour ordeal, not a single one of those 38 eyewitnesses came to her aid. They didn't shout out. They didn't call for help. They didn't run to her aid. They didn't come to her rescue. Nobody bothered to even pick up the phone and call the police. Now, it might be easy to pass it off by saying, well, it was 1964, and that was New York City, and it was obviously a one-time deal. I mean, that's not the norm. Oh, that would be so wrong. Any student of sociology knows exactly where I'm going with this. Because situations like that of Kitty Genovese have happened over and over again in cities and towns all over the land to such a degree that it now has a name. It's called the bystander problem. In fact, two New York City psychologists, one from Columbia and the other were from NYU, were the ones that termed it that for the literature, the bystander problem. And in a fascinating set of studies that was outlined by Malcolm Gladwell in his book, The Tipping Point, bestseller, you may have read The Tipping Point by Gladwell. He has a whole section on this in that book. These two psychologists decided that they would test the bystander problem, and so they staged a whole series of different emergencies in different settings to see if people would come and help. And what they discovered was fascinating. They wanted to find out, why is it we know people won't come to someone's rescue? In many situations, they wanted to know why. And they found out at the end there was one reason why. Why don't people respond? There's one big reason. It was not the severity of the crisis. It wasn't the degree to which the person screamed or called for help. It wasn't even the personal morality or character of the people in the experiment. It didn't matter even if they were young or old, male or female, black or white. What mattered was how many witnesses there were to the event. How many people they perceived were seeing what they were seeing. And the more people who were around, the more an individual would say, okay, then I'm not going to do anything. Because there's others. See, when people are in a group, responsibility for taking personal action is diffused. It gets watered down. They assume somebody else is going to make the call, or somebody else is going to report the problem, or somebody else is going to respond to the need. Or they assume that because nobody else is acting, then everybody must know something I don't know, and they must not be, I must not be interpreting what I'm seeing right, so that maybe it's really not that urgent. And so they don't do anything. So in the case of Kitty Genovese, social psychologists argue that the lesson isn't that no one called despite the fact that 38 people heard her screams. No, nobody called because 38 heard their scream. If she had been attacked on a lonely street with just one witness, she might have lived, because that one person might have felt an obligation. They would have been moved by the fact that it really was up to them. You know, at this point, I feel very strongly. I wish I could take all of you who are still exploring Christ off to the side, because I know this series is a little weird for you, and say, okay, let's just talk about what Jesus wanted you to get out of this story. And that you're going to die, the reality of hell, you think you're fine, Jesus thinks you're in trouble. Let's talk about that. Because he would want to talk about that with you. And then I also have a group of you that I want to take and say, why aren't you giving a flip about people facing a crisis of eternity? I'm going to have to choose. I'm going to choose the latter for at least this talk. Friends, do you realize that your friend, your family member, that person in your neighborhood, that person that you work with, who you know is not in a relationship with Christ, do you know they're in trouble? I mean, trouble. And not only that, do you realize it's your responsibility? That God has put them in your life, which means you're going to give an account one day for what you did with the people God has put in your life who don't know Him. I'll tell you, until you connect those two things, they're in trouble, my responsibility, until you do, you won't care about people the way Jesus cared about people. You will not lead a sent life, and you will not fulfill the destiny that He has for you. You'll never be urgent. I believe to the core of my being that this generation of Christians is responsible for this generation of non-Christians. It's as simple as that. It's as simple as that. We will stand before God and we will give an account of our lives in relation to whether we cared and whether we did anything. Most of you have probably heard by now of Kony 2012, the half-hour video on Joseph Kony, head of the Lord's Resistance Army, the man most wanted by the International Criminal Court for mass murder and crimes against children, largely in Uganda. In 1 week, it went from one view to more than 100 million views. It set viral history. It's being talked about all over the place. 100 million views in a single week. Now, there's been a lot said about that video since it went viral, whether the facts are presented fairly, the organization behind it, you know, about the government that is supported by the people who did the film and the pros and cons of that, and the latest that you probably have read about, the arrest of the man who made it, who was caught nude and drunk and erratic and, you know, was had to be taken away. But here's what I want us to think about. Many of you watched that video because somebody told you about it. Many of you then passed it on, and you posted it on Facebook. The power of passing something on is staggering. Well, let me state the obvious. Is there anything more important than passing on the message of Christ? Anything. I saw people get more exercised over that 29-minute film than the 33-year-old life of Christ. Dead men in hell get it. Why can't living Christians on their way to heaven? You know, I came across something from the annals of history once that has always stayed with me. It happened back in July of 1854. There was a well-known criminal by the name of Charlie Peace, and he was hung in London. And a ceremony was performed on his behalf before his hanging by an Anglican priest. It was very common for that day. An Anglican priest would always walk behind the condemned man who was walking to the gallows, and he would read to this man from the prayer book. And the words that were read were always the same. Those who die without Christ experience hell, which is the pain of forever dying without the release which death itself can bring. And when those chilling words were read by an Anglican priest, kind of doing it out of duty as Charlie Peace walked to the gallows, history records that Peace stopped in his tracks, turned around to the Anglican priest, and said, "Do you believe that? Do you believe that?" And the priest was taken aback. He never had anybody on the way to the gallows stop and turn around and say anything to him. And he said, "Well, yes. I suppose I do." And then Peace said, "Well, I don't. But if I did, I would get down on my hands and knees and crawl all over Great Britain, even if it were paved with pieces of broken glass, if I could rescue just one person from what you just told me. And then he went to the gallows. The urgency of Christ's commission and Christ's revolution was clear to a non-believer. And the responsibility. If it would only be as clear to those of us who believe. Folks, this is why we're maniacs around Mac, to reach out. It's why I have absolutely zero patience and zero tolerance for people who say, why do you spend so much energy on reaching out? I just want to look at them and I want to say, really? What Bible are you reading? Because I haven't read that one. It's why we're always inviting our friends. It's why we're spending so much effort and energy. And it's also why, if you're honest, many of you are here. You're here because you were invited. Please join with this. And, you know, as we're saying, and it's natural to bring it back, we've got a chance to put this into overdrive in just a couple of weeks. Really, do you get it? And I know many of you do. In just a couple of weeks is an event in our culture that still draws people naturally to church or makes them more open to an invitation than almost any other weekend in the entire year. People who would never normally attend will come if we invite them. They are one invitation away. Do you see the power of this? I mean, if somebody were to come to me and say, why are you going all that trouble with the cans? I think I'd tell them to bend over and let me show them. Folks, this is everything. And you can make the difference. You can do this. We can do this. So please, this is very simple. Let me just say it again. Lynn's went over it well, but let me just say it again here because I'll feel better. First, just pray. Get a prayer band like this and pray for our Easter event. Just pray. Let it remind you to do that. And then second, invite somebody. Invite somebody, someone at work, someone in your neighborhood. If you know of someone you can invite and you know that they're unchurched, you know that this is something that they would need, then, yeah, take it to the next level and grab one of those cans. Don't grab them arbitrarily just for fun. But if you know it's strategic, grab one and give it to them. Give it that extra boost, that little bit of, you know, edge to it, that little bit of added impression. And you want to make something go viral? Try Easter@Verizon.org, where the message of Christ will actually be a part of it. And here's why. Here's why. This is all they hear. It's all they hear. And they have no idea what song it is. But you do. We do. It's the song of Jesus. And we can give it to him. Okay, let's stand for a closing prayer. Lord God, right now I pray for everybody listening to this who may be like the rich man, and they're still wrestling with the reality of all of this. And this was kind of probably one of the weirder talks they've heard around Mac, and that's okay. I feel good about the risk. But I pray that they'll wrestle with the story that Jesus told from their perspective. For those of us who have already embraced the truth of it, I pray that we will wrestle with the challenge the story gives to reach out to those around us. I pray that in the name of Jesus.